Okay, great. Well, so I do want to talk to you guys today about spike timing dependent plasticity. And as I mentioned before, I want to take it from at least initially a low-level biological perspective. What is it? How does it work? What do we think of in a simplistic way that it's trying to do for information storage in the nervous system? And that I think will encompass about the first half of what we talk about today. And then the second half, I want to give you guys some concrete examples that approach a question that's been kind of difficult in the neurobiology of learning, which is to say we can come up with all sorts of interesting learning rules and formalisms for what might be happening at synapses to store information. But what is the hard experimental data that's out there that actually proves that a particular learning role, in this case STDP, actually is engaged in real brains doing things and is contributing to information storage? So that'll be the two halves. And interrupt me at any time. I want to start out with a general concept, and from your backgrounds, it sounds like you're all very aware of this, that there's a long history in neuroscience of making an informed assumption, as I like to think of it, that the relevant mechanisms for information storage during learning and other types of adaptive properties of the brain is by plasticity at synapses. And this is an idea that's at least 100 years old, goes back to William James, but many people have stated it in many different ways. And a useful way, I think, of starting to talk about it is the classical Hebbian formalism, which I just want to go over for those of you who aren't familiar with it. Does anybody here not know, haven't heard of Donald Hebb? Everybody has, good. So you know then that the basic Hebbian learning rule, which I just have just reprinted here, is that if you have a synapse with some presynaptic inputs, let's call them A, B, C, and some postsynaptic cell, Hebb postulated that when an axon of one of these cells, cell A, is near enough, or nowadays we would say is strong enough or works well enough together with other inputs to consistently cause the postsynaptic cell to fire, then some growth process or metabolic change takes place in either one of these two cells such that the efficiency of A as a synapse firing B is increased, which nowadays we would say the strength of the synapse increases. So this basic idea, which was proposed more than 50 years ago, I think the modern restatement would be that we know every given cell is integrating many hundreds or thousands of inputs. No one of those inputs, for virtually all cells in the brain, no one of those inputs is ever powerful enough to cause that cell to fire on its own. So when one of those inputs works together, is coactive with other ones, enough that their inputs sum to strongly activate the postsynaptic cell, then this would satisfy the Hebbian requirement for strengthening the synapse. Now, Hebb didn't propose, but it was an extension of this was proposed about 30 years later by Gunther Stent, that if a given presynaptic input is active but consistently fails to be able to fire the postsynaptic cell, then that synapse may be weakened. And now we know from lots of research, as you guys I'm sure know, that in fact there's a mechanism of long-term potentiation which does exactly this. There's a mechanism of long-term depression of synapses which does exactly that. So I hope this isn't too low for you guys to see, but some basic features of this Hebbian, I'm going to call both the potentiation and the depression aspects of Hebbian synaptic plasticity. And so this type of learning rule has a couple of important functional consequences. One of them is that plasticity is associative, and by that I mean that it's really temporal correlations between the firing of a subset of inputs, which cause those inputs in some sense to work together, and then they both get strengthened on the postsynaptic cell, and this is a way of providing inputs that are active at the same time to associatively wire up under the same cells. And of course, associative forms of plasticity are very, very useful in implementing many different kinds of learning in neural networks. Okay. In addition, these forms of plasticity are synapse specific. If a particular presynaptic input can engage and fire the postsynaptic cell, that one synapse or that set of synapses is potentiated, and other neighboring synapses are generally not potentiated, although there are some exceptions to that rule. And in addition, something that is really inherent to Hebb's statement of the rule, but as you'll see in a few minutes, I think has been a little bit lost in most modern analyses of this type of plasticity, is the issue of causality. That is, Hebb says that you should strengthen a synapse when the axon reliably or consistently helps to drive a spike in the postsynaptic cell. That is, the spike here helps to drive a response in a spike here. That's a causal kind of statement. But in fact, as you'll see, most of the ways that people think about this has to do with a simple temporal correlation. When there's activity here, there has to more or less be activity here at the same time. And if so, we'll strengthen the synapse. That's certainly an approximation of a causal rule, but it's not exactly a causal rule. Okay. So I was going to give you about 10 minutes of a basic background for people who haven't thought about LTP and LTD and how they really work in synapses. Based on your backgrounds, we could not do this. Let me just ask you guys, how many of you think it would be worthwhile to have, we could do this in 5 minutes, a 5 minute recap of how LTP is measured, how LTD is measured, and what's basically known about their mechanisms? Okay, all right, let's do it. So Hebb's idea was actually very popular but remained a complete hypothesis until the 1970s. Actually, in 1966, there was an abstract, and in 1973, there was a paper by Tim Bliss and Terry Lomo, who took a slice of the hippocampus, looked at a particular synapse in it, it doesn't really matter for us which one it is, and they found that if they stimulated the presynaptic cell every few minutes, and they measured the strength of the synaptic response, which is what's plotted here on the y-axis, and they repeated that stimulation every few minutes, in this case for 6 hours in a slice, this is a field potential recording of summed activity across many cells, they're monitoring the response of these cells to two separate pathways of input, one coming from one set of presynaptic cells, another coming from another set of presynaptic cells under that same common postsynaptic target. And initially, these two inputs start out at approximately the same strength here. Actually, they're probably normalized to be the same strength. And then at the time of the arrow, what Bliss and Lomo did was they simply took one of those inputs and they applied voltage pulses to the slice to stimulate it tetanically, that is to make it fire about 100 hertz, blah, 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 for many pulses. That's called a tetanus. And the result of a tetanus on one pathway, the black pathway, was to increase the strength of the synaptic response, to potentiate the synapse for that pathway, but to leave the other one unchanged. They could repeat the tetanus again, it would get a little bit stronger, they repeat it again, it would get a little bit stronger, they repeat it again even stronger, and it's synapse-specific because the synapse that's being potentiated is the one that's being tetanized and not the other one. So this was long-term potentiation, or LTP. Now, almost 20 years after that, there was a discovery of long-term depression, LTD, which is really the converse effect. And this was also discovered in the hippocampus. And here, similar experiment is shown, measuring the strength, in this case by the initial slope of a field potential, an EPSP, as a function of time with just repeated stimulation now of the same single pathway throughout the whole experiment. And after obtaining a stable baseline, now they induce plasticity not by tetanizing with 100 hertz, very, very fast stimulation, but instead they give this very, it's called low-frequency stimulation, or LFS. It's 1 hertz firing for many minutes, about 15 minutes of pop, 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 pop once a second. And if you do that for 15 minutes here, they're not plotting the data during it, but afterwards you can see that synaptic strength goes down. It may recover a little bit here, but basically you get stable depression of that synapse. That's long-term depression, or LTD. I won't go through the data, but there's a figured planet down there showing it's also synapse-specific. It applies to the pathway you induce it on. Okay. One of those, LTP, was produced by 100 hertz firing. The other one, LTD, was produced by 1 hertz firing. And over the years, people have done experiments to assess different frequencies of conditioning stimuli and ask, do they produce LTP or LTD or no change? Okay, and that's what's plotted here. And this is one set of studies from the hippocampus, but it's been replicated many times. Very low frequencies of firing produce no change in synaptic strength. That is, synapses are stable if a synapse just gets activated every 10 seconds or 20 seconds or 30 seconds. However, if you start to activate the synapse more than that every second, right, or 3 times a second or 5 times a second, then that induces long-term depression. And if you stimulate it here at 50 times a second, or not shown here at 100 times a second, that potentiates it, and there's a crossover point in between. And so there's a systematic relationship between the frequency at which you make a presynaptic axon fire and the resulting LTP or LTD. Okay, and we call this firing frequency dependent or rate dependent LTP and LTD. So this would be a learning rule for that form of plasticity. Okay, now I'm showing you this for hippocampus, but there's a huge literature on this, and it's been shown that LTP and LTD occur at virtually every excitatory synapse that's been looked at in the brain. And because of the similarities between, at many levels, between these plasticity mechanisms and Hebb's rule, it's been widely assumed that these forms of plasticity are actually involved in different types of learning and memory and information storage. And I won't go through the literature on this because this would take days to do, but there's a huge literature, and you guys are probably familiar with parts of this, testing whether mechanistically LTP and LTD are really involved in information storage in the CNS. And my impression of that, to summarize something that's so large that it's almost unsummarizable, is that in general there are many examples where if you block LTP and LTD with different types of manipulations, you can block important aspects of learning. Sometimes you can block virtually all of learning. There are some key exceptions where it hasn't worked, and that has led people to question whether specific forms of LTP and LTD, or even these phenomena in general, underlie all forms of learning and memory, but certainly for many forms, I think the evidence is very good that they're involved.
Here it looks like LTD is optimal around 2 hertz. Would that be true for all synapses, or does that vary between?
You know, it hasn't been looked at terribly extensively across synapses. It hasn't been carefully parameterized. But it's also true that there's some important caveats in the way that experiment is conducted. You can change certain things about the way you conduct it. For example, how strongly you stimulate, which means how many axons you stimulate at once, and that will actually change this rule for firing rate. So it's not, I don't think, particularly all that meaningful to say that 2 hertz is a magic frequency for getting LTD and 100 hertz for LTP, and that's actually one thing we'll talk about when we talk about STDP. Oh, yeah, sure.
What distinguishes excitatory synapses?
You mean what makes...
What is an excitatory synapse?
The question is, what is an excitatory synapse? So neurons have different transmitters, and neurons that use glutamate in the mammalian CNS tend to depolarize their postsynaptic partners. Depolarizing that partner will cause them to spike. Any transmitter that causes a postsynaptic cell to spike more readily is called an excitatory transmitter. So glutamatergic neurons that make their postsynaptic partners spike are excitatory, and that's distinguished from a whole other set of neurons, which I'm not talking about here, called inhibitory neurons, that use a different neurotransmitter, either glycine or GABA, and they actually prevent the postsynaptic cell from spiking. Those are inhibitory neurons. They behave completely differently. They're derived from totally different precursor neurons early in development. Everything is really different about those neurons. The question is whether this was done in vivo. What I've told you about right now is mostly done in slices, although there have been experiments where you can implant stimulating electrodes in the hippocampus of awake-behaving animals running around their cage. You can stimulate with 100 hertz or 1 hertz stimuli, and you can measure the responses, and you can show that you can get the same thing in vivo, and it lasts for weeks. But I'm going to tell you at the end of the lecture today, I think, about more convincing examples that LTP and LTD are actually engaged in vivo during real learning tasks. All right, so I want to get to STDP and the mechanisms of it. And in order to do that, I want to reacquaint you with what's known about the basic mechanisms, the cellular mechanisms that implement LTP and LTD as defined here. Okay, there was a huge effort back in the 80s to figure out what is it about 100 hertz firing that causes that synapse to potentiate. And a key experiment that I think set the tone for a lot of how we think about plasticity is shown here. Actually, two experiments published at the same time. What these experiments both showed is that the critical thing about 100 hertz firing is that during 100 hertz firing, EPSPs are being produced right during each presynaptic spike, or in response to each presynaptic spike, and those EPSPs summate because neurons are integrators, and that means that the postsynaptic cell is getting more and more and more and more depolarized during the tetanus, so that ultimately, once you're halfway through the tetanus, you have a strongly firing axon and a very highly depolarized, probably firing postsynaptic cell, and it's the postsynaptic depolarization which turns out to be critical for driving LTP. So, for example, if you do an LTP experiment where you're plotting the amplitude of your synaptic response over time, same as I've shown you before, but you first inject current into the postsynaptic cell to make it spike alone, but your presynaptic cell is not firing, that postsynaptic depolarization alone doesn't drive plasticity. Likewise, if you make the presynaptic cell fire at 100 hertz, but you use a technical trick called voltage clamp to keep the postsynaptic cell from depolarizing, so now you have presynaptic activity but not postsynaptic activity, that also doesn't produce LTP. Here's a repeat of that same thing again. But now when you finally put the two together, strong presynaptic activity plus postsynaptic depolarization, that's when you get LTP. Here's another example from a famous experiment from Robert Malino in hippocampus, showing just summary data that when you provide your tetanus and you don't artificially hyperpolarize your postsynaptic cell, so you let it depolarize, that's when you get this big LTP of synaptic transmission. This is the mean synaptic response before and after tetanus. But if you do exactly the same protocol, but now during the tetanus, you artificially inject negative current in the postsynaptic cell to keep it from depolarizing, then you don't get LTP. So the bottom line is, it's postsynaptic depolarization that's critical for allowing a synapse to potentiate. And here's a summary slide of how we now think about the mechanisms for most forms of LTP and LTD, not all of them. Okay. The critical thing is synaptic transmission at glutamatergic synapses. Most of you probably know that axon terminals contain vesicles of neurotransmitter. In the case of excitatory synapses, that transmitter is glutamate. And when an action potential comes down the terminal, glutamate is released. And glutamate binds to several different types of receptors on the postsynaptic side, but the main ones we need to consider here are what are called the AMPA-type glutamate receptor and the NMDA-type glutamate receptor. The AMPA-type glutamate receptor simply opens up its channel whenever glutamate is bound, and when this channel is open, current flows in and depolarizes the postsynaptic cell. Okay, that is what's responsible for sort of standard synaptic transmission. But the second receptor, the NMDA receptor, is built differently. It has a binding site not just for glutamate, but also for magnesium. And when magnesium, which is present all the time, when it's bound, that actually prevents current from flowing through the channel pore. And so this magnesium provides a special property, and the property works like this. Magnesium is a divalent positively charged ion, and so it's attracted to negatively charged spaces. The inside of the postsynaptic cell is one such negatively charged space. And so when the postsynaptic cell is sitting at its normal resting potential, that is hyperpolarized, negative charge, the magnesium is drawn in and is sitting in its binding site all the time and is held there. And therefore, when glutamate is released here, if the postsynaptic cell is at relatively normal V-rest, then AMPA receptors will open and let current flow in, but NMDA receptors won't because they're blocked by magnesium. It's only when the postsynaptic cell is strongly depolarized, which turns out to be by 15 or 20 millivolts or more, that there's now a relief of the hyperpolarization postsynaptically that allows magnesium to escape, and under that case, now current can flow in. And so that means that when the presynaptic axon is active, pop, 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 but the postsynaptic cell is not, NMDA receptors aren't functioning. But when the presynaptic cell is active and the postsynaptic cell is depolarized, then the NMDA receptor is open, current flows in, and NMDA receptors are specialized that when they allow current to flow, calcium is one of the major ions that flows in. And so only under this condition does calcium come in through NMDA receptors, and it's this calcium which ends up driving strengthening of the synapse. Okay? So the critical thing is depolarization, and it works by allowing calcium to come through NMDA receptors to trigger LTP.
So to trigger LTP, do you need spikes? It looks like you don't need spikes. You just need...
This is a great question, and this is a question that I think was originally asked back in the 80s during these first... Oh, repeat the question. The question is, are spikes required as the source of depolarization? So this was really looked at a lot in the 80s, and people came up with the general conclusion that depolarization is needed, but the form of depolarization was never really quite settled on. And more recently, we'll talk about a little bit later how this has been revisited with spike timing dependent plasticity. And I don't think it's still resolved, but I think we understand a little bit more about how spikes can provide the depolarization and when they can and when they can't, actually. Okay, so that's the basic mechanism. Now, many of you might be interested in what happens between calcium and LTP. I actually wasn't planning on going into that. This has been a problem that has defined the field of LTP for many, many years. The bottom line of all that is that at many synapses, there's good evidence that what this calcium does is it initiates a signaling cascade that adds more AMPA receptors to the postsynaptic side, such that from now on, every time a vesicle of glutamate is released, it activates instead of, let's say, one AMPA receptor, now it activates two, and so the strength of the synapse is doubled. So that's a lot of interesting stuff there. Now let's get back to the form of these learning rules and what they can do. And I mentioned at the beginning that there's an approximation that we've all made in thinking about how LTP and LTD may be Hebbian mechanisms, in that we think about temporal correlations between pre- and postsynaptic spikes as a critical requirement. And in fact, here's an experiment that was one of the early ones that established this. This is an experiment from Wigström and Gustafsson. And what they did was they stimulated two different synaptic pathways under the same cell and hippocampus, recording the strength of response to the first pathway over time, the strength of the response to the second pathway over time. And in this experiment, they stimulate an action potential from one of the presynaptic pathways, and then they inject a little bit of current through their recording electrode into the postsynaptic cell to depolarize it. So in every single sweep of the experiment, each one of these dots, over 40 minutes, there's both presynaptic activity and postsynaptic activity. However, what they do during almost all of the experiment, everywhere except this little black bar, they separate those two things by 400 milliseconds. So the presynaptic cell fires, pop, 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 and then they wait, actually, in this case, it's probably just one or two bops, pop, pop, two spikes, and they wait 400 milliseconds, and then they depolarize the postsynaptic cell to make its spike, pop, 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 400 milliseconds apart. And doing that, they're doing it to input one and input two, and just by looking at input two, you can see that that treatment does nothing. When the pre- and postsynaptic depolarizations are separated by 400 milliseconds, no plasticity is induced. However, during the bar, this time period, what they do is just for the input one inputs, they move that depolarization up in time so that now it's only, I think it was 7 milliseconds in this particular panel, away from the presynaptic input. So now they're much more temporally correlated, only 7 milliseconds apart, and that pairing or conjunction causes potentiation of that one pathway. And this and many other experiments like it have been used to estimate what the critical window for temporal correlation is over which pre- and postsynaptic activity working together can drive LTP. And the answer has been somewhere around 50 milliseconds, sometimes out to 100 milliseconds. So the idea for these learning rules has been that correlated firing, temporally correlated firing on this time scale drives LTP. And if you implement uncorrelated firing, let's say randomly timed firing in both cells, then depending on the synapse, sometimes you see no plasticity at all, like you see here, and sometimes you see LTD. So this idea of firing rate dependent LTP and LTD really led to the idea that the critical aspect of activity is the temporal correlation between pre- and postsynaptic firing. And when that correlation is high and the activity is strong, you get LTP. And when the correlation is weak, you either get nothing or you get LTD. So firing rate translates into postsynaptic depolarization, and then the correlation between the two gives you plasticity. And that makes sense if you think about the NMDA receptors, right? Because the NMDA receptors require presynaptic glutamate at the same time that they get postsynaptic depolarization. Okay. I think I neglected to mention, by the way, in this mechanism that what's the difference between LTP and LTD? Well, you get LTP if the postsynaptic cell is strongly depolarized to let a lot of calcium in. That initiates the calcium-dependent signaling cascade to drive LTP. But if you have a weaker correlation between the two, you can have some depolarization, but not as much in the postsynaptic cell. That will relieve some of the magnesium block, but not all, and you get now a little bit of calcium signal instead of a big one. And that small calcium signal has been shown to be able to activate a different signaling cascade in the postsynaptic cell, and that's what's thought to lead to LTD. So it's the amount of depolarization and the magnitude of that calcium signal which is thought to be the difference.
So the entry of the sodium ion is driven simply by voltage differentials, right?
So the sodium ion comes in because of standard biophysics of the Nernst potential that says when a sodium channel is open, given these ionic concentrations, sodium will flow in.
But for the calcium to repolarize, you've got to do work.
Well, the calcium, the question is, how does the calcium come in? The calcium is also flowing down its electrochemical gradient because these cells, calcium is a very special signaling ion in neurons, and the neuron dedicates a lot of ATP to getting the calcium out of its cytosol. It pumps it into stores, it pumps it out of the cell. There's a very, very low concentration in the cytosol, and so there's a very strong driving force for it to come in, actually, when those channels are open. Probably also a signal that it's doing something important when it gets there. Oops, yeah.
As you decrease the time interval between the presynaptic and the postsynaptic, you should also increase the frequency of the tetrams, right? Because otherwise, at some point, the period of the frequency would be longer than the window of the time interval.
Well, that
is it. The frequency of tetrams that's causing that, or
so. This is a great question. The question is, what's really the mechanistic relationship between the frequency of tetanus, the temporal correlation between pre- and postsynaptic firing, and let me add one more thing, the strength of depolarization in the postsynaptic cell. And in many of these early experiments, they can't be dissociated. And they can't be dissociated because you have to activate your presynaptic input typically with more than one spike. You have to activate your postsynaptic input with some duration of depolarization. You can bring those together or apart in time, but usually that leaves you with fairly coarse time intervals that you can really manipulate independently from, let's say, the amount of depolarization happening during the synaptic response. There are experiments that I'm not going to tell you about here where you can show that it's actually postsynaptic depolarization, which is the key variable, because you can make a presynaptic axon fire just once, And if you correlate that release event from the presynaptic axon with a strong postsynaptic depolarization that you've artificially produced by injecting current in the cell, you can get LTP. And if you pair it with a weak depolarization by injecting a little bit of current in the cell, you can get LTD. So it's really the amount of depolarization that's critical. Yeah, the question is, how do these different levels of calcium drive LTP and LTD? And the best supported model that's out there, and there's a lot of good data for this, is a model that originated with John Lisman at Brandeis. And he noticed that there actually had been two major kinase and phosphatase signaling pathways in the postsynaptic dendrite that had been identified to be relevant for LTP and LTD. The kinase pathway, which involves largely CAM kinase, had been shown to be required for LTP, whereas a phosphatase pathway, which ends up kind of undoing many of the things that the kinase pathway does, works sort of opposite, had been identified as being important for LTD. And what Lisman noticed was that the KD of those kinases for calcium is quite different. So the kinase requires a lot of calcium to be activated. And so only a lot of calcium coming in through the NMDA receptor is sufficient to activate the kinase pathway, leading to LTP, is the theory. Whereas lower levels of calcium are actually sufficient to activate the phosphatase pathway. And so when a modest amount comes in, you do activate the pathway, which can lead to LTD. So the idea is that there's this kinase and phosphatase signaling system, which are set up to be able to read out different levels of calcium and to initiate different signaling cascades to drive one process versus the other.
So if you're activating the phosphatase pathway,
yeah, and this is where the details of the mechanism are not quite known. There's been some argument that there's mutual inhibition between those two pathways, so that if you activate them both, the kinase pathway will win somehow. There's been other evidence that when you drive the synapse strongly, you actually induce both LTP and LTD, but you induce more LTP, and so that wins out. It's not, I think, 100% clear what's going on across synapses there. Okay. Right. So this historical interlude brings us to spike timing-dependent plasticity. And let me define for you what it is, and then let's talk about how it could potentially solve some of the problems that are inherent in the rate and correlation-dependent forms of plasticity that we just talked about. So what is this? This is a form of LTP and LTD. That's all it is. In fact, there's nothing mechanistically distinct about spike timing-dependent plasticity from standard LTP and LTD that anybody has identified so far. However, what it is it's a way, it's a means of inducing LTP and LTD by simply changing the precise millisecond scale timing of pre- and postsynaptic spikes. And so the basic phenomenon is that if you imagine a synapse onto the dendrites of some neuron, if you make the presynaptic axon fire at time t, and of course, when it fires, it releases transmitter and produces a little bit of an EPSP at the postsynaptic side of the synapse, right? And then a few milliseconds later, you make the postsynaptic cell fire one spike. These are both single spikes. Then that postsynaptic spike here seems to interact with the presynaptic spike or the EPSP, so that when the order is pre-spike leads post-spike, that generates LTP at that synapse. Whereas if you gave the same single presynaptic spike and single postsynaptic spike, but now you reverse the order so that the postsynaptic spike comes first before the presynaptic spike, this order of events drives LTD. Okay. The signaling pathways for doing this we'll go into in a little bit, so I'm actually not going to talk about now, but what are the basic features of this? This was discovered more or less in 1996, 1997, but since then it's been seen at many synapses, well over two dozen synapses now in very different parts of the brain. And so it seems to be a fairly prominent form of plasticity, particularly in the cortex. It has strongly Hebbian properties, which we'll go through in a second. Okay. It also has a couple of key features which are computationally very useful for learning rules, which classical rate-dependent LTP and LTD do not. For example, rate-dependent LTP and LTD have a big positive feedback instability, where once a synapse starts to get stronger, the postsynaptic cell starts to fire more, and therefore you get more LTP, and the synapse gets even stronger, et cetera. And there are features of these rules that, if they're implemented correctly in neural models, have put some brakes on that process. And one of them is that they can act in networks to normalize postsynaptic firing rates, which prevents some of that runaway excitation. And we can talk about that if you're interested. Another computational issue is that for many types of plasticity that can be experimentally studied in the brain, it can be shown that if you strengthen the effectiveness of a certain set of inputs onto a given postsynaptic cell, that that often causes a weakening of other inputs onto the cell. That is, there's some competition between sets of inputs onto cells or within given regions of circuits. And there's actually no aspect of firing rate dependent plasticity which predicts that competition. However, that competition comes automatically from spike time independent learning rules, suggesting it may be something realistic in the brain. And again, we can talk about that more later. Let me show you what it is, though, with some experimental data. This is from the first study from Henry Markram's group. What they did was they record from two layer 5 cells in primary somatosensory cortex. They're hard to see here. They're both filled with dye. This is the soma of one cell. This is the soma of the other cell. These are the long dendrites. The little dashed things are the axons. The dots are where they make synaptic connections. But the only important thing for you is that they patched a presynaptic cell that made a synapse onto a postsynaptic cell that they also patched. Okay? So they can inject current to make the presynaptic cell spike. They can inject current to make the postsynaptic cell spike, and they can also record the strength of the synaptic response in that same postsynaptic cell. So here's the basic experiment. In this case, what they did was they injected little pulses of depolarizing current that were long enough to produce a little burst, in this case of about 4 spikes, pop, pop, pop. And when they did that in the presynaptic cell, they could measure the EPSPs, the synaptic responses, that resulted in the postsynaptic cell, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? And that they recorded these responses as a function of time in the experiment. And if they injected these current pulses to drive EPSPs only, that is, they're activating the presynaptic cell, but they're not making the postsynaptic cell spike, then there was no change in the strength of the response. This is the strength of the synapse here. But if they elicited presynaptic spikes at the same time that they elicited postsynaptic spikes together, then they would often get LTP. And the order of events was sort of schematized here. Imagine this is the membrane potential of the first cell, presynaptic cell. This is the membrane potential of the postsynaptic cell. And actually, in this case, the cells were coupled in both directions. So each one is the presynaptic cell at its synapse. Each one is the postsynaptic cell at its synapse. So when they cause spikes to be fired from the first cell, that elicits EPSPs, which are hard to see down there, but are blown up there in the second cell. And when they elicit spikes from the second cell, that causes EPSPs in the first cell. Okay. Now, what they did was they, by timing when they injected this current, they could make these spikes happen with different pre-post intervals. And they noticed that if they plotted the amplitude of the spike as a change from, the amplitude of the postsynaptic response as a change from baseline, as a function of time here, that if they had the presynaptic spike occurring before the postsynaptic spike, pre-leading post, by 10 millisecond interval, then they would get potentiation. But if they reversed the order, as I mentioned before, then they would get depression, 10 milliseconds. But if they move them farther apart in time, 100 milliseconds apart, then they would get no plasticity at all. So it's the order or the timing of these spikes within about somewhere around a 10 millisecond window, which is critical. Now, how is it that a synapse way out in the dendritic tree knows when the postsynaptic cell has spiked? It's implicit in a learning rule like this. It must know when. And actually, in the same issue of Science that first paper came out, a really nice study showing how that could happen came out from McGee and Johnston, from Dan Johnston's lab. And what they showed, which is something which is now absolutely proven in many, many cells in the nervous system, but at the time was a real shock, was that action potentials, when they're generated in the soma, don't just go down the axon. They also go back up the dendrite. These are the back-propagating action potentials, which I'll call BAPs, or back-propagating spikes. This is completely different, from back-propagation as a learning algorithm. It has nothing to do with it. It just shares, unfortunately, a name. So here's an example of how they saw that. This is an experiment where they're recording from this cell. They filled it with dye. This is a calcium-sensitive dye. So by imaging the fluorescence from this dye, they can measure indirectly the concentration of calcium. Calcium is a great readout for strong depolarization because neurons have voltage-sensitive calcium channels that when the neuron depolarizes, calcium comes in and makes the dye glow more. Okay. So here's the first part of the experiment. Okay. They're doing two things. They're measuring the calcium dye, and then they have a recording electrode in the soma of the cell through which they can record and elicit spikes. And they have a recording electrode way out at the distal tip of the dendrite where they can record membrane potential in the dendrite. So the first thing they do is they inject some current in the soma to produce three spikes. And here they are, pop, pop, pop. Okay? And then they record out in the dendrites what they see. The small a is when they deliver action potentials alone. And what they see, amazingly, are little action potentials out in the dendrite, not so little really, 20 or 30 millivolt depolarization. It's pretty strong spikes. Okay. When they produce small depolarizations or just EPSPs in the soma, they don't backpropagate out to the dendrite effectively, but spikes do. And they can see that in the calcium signal as well. One of these two big signals here is the calcium signal in the soma from producing a spike in the soma. And out here, the ones labeled A, this middle one here, this middle one here, this middle one here, those are the calcium signals in the dendrite from that one spike. So you start a spike in the soma, it backpropagates up through the dendritic tree, causing calcium to come in wherever it gets to. Now, I won't go through many experiments on this, but we now know that what happens is dendrites in many cell types have a low density of voltage-activated sodium channels, the same sodium channels that drive spikes in the axon. They're at lower density in the dendrite, so that means that they're just enough density to get a spike to backpropagate actively, but as it backpropagates, it doesn't actually stay exactly the same amplitude and go forever down the dendrites like it does the axon. Instead, it starts to backpropagate. It starts out big, but then it gets smaller and smaller and weaker and smaller and weaker, and then it eventually dies out. And in a cell like this, it probably backpropagates very effectively for 400 or 500 microns up the apical dendrite, even into the small branches, but then it dies out and it becomes smaller and smaller and eventually goes away. So what McGee and Johnson proposed is what a great signal for a synapse to know whether the soma spiked, right, if it can sense the backpropagating action potential.
For that 400 microns or 500 microns, how long does that take?
How long does it take to backpropagate? It's very rapid. It happens within a 2 or 3 millisecond delay. So for our purposes, it's essentially instantaneous. The spike does get fatter as it backpropagates, but the initial depolarization of the spike is very fast, and that's because just like in an axon, the time for propagation is dependent on simply passive depolarization of the next little segment of the dendrite and then opening up the sodium channels, which is very fast. It's a regenerative event.
Looking at reversing correction between neurons rather than within neurons,
The question is, does LTP and LTD just alter the postsynaptic side of the synapse or also the presynaptic side? This has been the huge 15-year debate that I was trying to sidestep and summarize. But there is very strong evidence that the postsynaptic side of the synapse is altered, in particular by adding or subtracting AMPA receptors during LTP or LTD. At certain synapses, there's also pretty good evidence that there can be some presynaptic changes, but the weight of evidence, I think, is much stronger for post than pre. That's not saying presynaptic doesn't happen also, but we certainly know that postsynaptic changes occur.
Does this mean that LTP and LTD are proximate dendrites?
That's a great question. So does the fact that the backpropagating spike is stronger proximally than distally, does that mean there's more chance of getting LTP proximally than distally? And that is absolutely true. Yeah. Okay. I won't go through this for the sake of time. This is just showing that when the backpropagating spike causes depolarization at some distal part of the synapse, that depolarization is enough to relieve the magnesium block on NMDA receptors and let calcium come in through NMDA receptors, which is required for LTP and LTD. So these backpropagating spikes, they provide the depolarization that can drive LTP and LTD. Now, given those very basic mechanisms, let's look at the learning rules. Okay, so what's plotted here is from a famous early paper by Guochang Bi and Wuming Pu from 1998, and they plotted over a large number of cells, and these are from recordings in cultured hippocampal neurons that grew into networks in a dish and made synapses with each other in a dish. They can record from pre- and postsynaptic cells. They can do exactly the Markram experiment, play with the timing of pre- and postsynaptic spikes, and ask how much LTP or LTD occurred. So this is the amount of LTP or the amount of LTD that occurred as a function of timing of spikes between the pre- and postsynaptic cells during the pairing protocol. Zero is simultaneous spiking. This direction is increasing delays of post-leading pre, and here increasing delays of pre-leading post. And you can see the pattern is that when the presynaptic spike leads the postsynaptic spike by up to maybe 20 milliseconds, this area here, then you get very prominent LTP. And when the order is reversed, you get prominent LTD. And for delays of, let's say, 50 milliseconds or longer, there's not much plasticity. Okay. Now, this is you can't get a simpler reduced in vitro preparation than a bunch of neurons that you ripped out of the hippocampus, tore all their dendrites and axons off, let them regrow together in a dish, and now are supplying spikes for them. And so from the get-go, it became interesting to know, does this actually happen in intact networks? And another early paper from the Poo Lab from Zhang et al. Showed that, in fact, you can go in vivo. This is recordings that are made in a Xenopus tectum. That's the superior colliculus of a frog. The retina of the frog provides a strong synaptic input to cells in the colliculus. And you can either electrically stimulate the cells in the retina to make those are the presynaptic cells for the synapse, to make them spike. Or you can flash them with light to make them spike. And then in the postsynaptic cell where you're recording, you can impose depolarizations by either injecting current or by letting cells respond naturally to the inputs they're getting. And in either case, you get the same kind of relationship where, so no matter how you do the manipulation, but now this is in vivo, and they plotted this with the order of the axes reversed, but it means the same thing. When the presynaptic spike leads the post, that's when you get potentiation over about a 20 millisecond window. And when post leads pre, you get depression over about a 20 millisecond window. So these were the classic definitions, first definitions of spike timing dependent plasticity. Now, why did people get so excited about this? It's because if you look at these plots, you see Hebbian plasticity with causality actually implemented. It's only when the presynaptic spike leads the post, which means, because the presynaptic spike by definition drives some sort of synaptic potential, it means that that presynaptic spike helped to drive the postsynaptic spike. That's causal. And under that case, you get the synapse being rewarded with LTP. And when the order is reversed, what does that mean? It means your postsynaptic cell is active, it's spiking. So is your presynaptic cell, it's active, it's spiking. But those spikes from the presynaptic cell are not themselves driving responses in the postsynaptic cell, at least not driving consistent responses. And so that is that causes a weakening of the synapse. So that's kind of the LTD side of the rule. So many people argue that this is, in fact, precisely the Hebbian learning rule. So this predicts kind of the causality side of the Hebbian proposal that was missing for many years. But what about that other side? I mentioned that at many synapses, uncorrelated firing drives depression. That's not inherently a causal kind of equation, but it does tell you that the learning rule that's responsible for that has to be able to sense correlations and not just temporal order and causality. How can we do that with STDP rules? Well, it turns out that there are different flavors of STDP rules at different synapses, and one relatively common form of them occurs in somatosensory cortex at the synapse between layer 4 cells and layer 2-3 cells. This is work that came out of my lab a few years ago. And we could show that these synapses also show spike timing dependent plasticity. Here's the strength of the synapse as a function of time. We can get just a stable baseline synaptic response by just stimulating the presynaptic cell every so often to measure synaptic response properties. And then we try to induce plasticity by injecting some current into the postsynaptic cell we're recording from. And this is precisely time, such that in this experiment, the postsynaptic spike comes 3 milliseconds after the presynaptic spike. So it's pre-leading post by 3 milliseconds. That causes LTP. When you reverse the order, postsynaptic spike first and then presynaptic spike, you can get LTD. This turns out to be robust, like at many other synapses. Whenever pre leads post, you get LTP. Whenever post leads pre, you get LTD. If you have presynaptic spiking only or postsynaptic spiking only, you get no plasticity. I won't go through the data, but you can even get it with very brief changes in the timing of spikes. But here's what the learning rule looks like. Okay, similar to what I showed you for the B and Pu and Zhang rules, except this is pre-leading post, this is post-leading pre. You get LTP when the presynaptic spike leads to the postsynaptic spike within that same brief window they found, about 20 milliseconds. But you get LTD in a much broader temporal range that can go up to 50 or 100 milliseconds, depending on various parameters. And so the integral of the LTD window, shown here, is bigger than the integral for the LTP window. And we now know that this kind of learning rule occurs at many different synapses. So we call this an LTD-biased STDP rule. And why is this interesting to think about? Because this solves the problem of how do you create a learning rule that's both sensitive to causality and to general correlations. This does both. Think about, in this learning rule, what is required to produce LTP. In order to generate LTP, you need to have a situation where the presynaptic cell consistently fires before the postsynaptic cell, at least on average, within that tight LTP window where causality is required, right? But in order to generate LTD, you have two ways of getting LTD with a rule like this. Either you can have the postsynaptic cell firing reliably before the presynaptic cell at some time within this window. That's the classic STDP way of getting LTD. Or you can have it if the two cells fire in an uncorrelated manner. Because if they're firing in an uncorrelated manner, they sample all possible delta T's between pre- and postsynaptic spikes. And on average, those delta T's will fall in this window more than that window, and therefore you'll accrue more LTD than LTP. And actually, we could show that that's what happens in the slice. Here's an LTP experiment where we're measuring the strength of a baseline response. And once the baseline is stable, we now inject current into the postsynaptic cell to make it spike. We stimulate the presynaptic axon to make it spike. But now, for every sweep of that pairing, we change the delta T to make those fire in an uncorrelated manner. And when you do that, you have to choose the temporal window over which things were uncorrelated. And so for this experiment, we chose delta T's that varied between plus or minus 50 milliseconds. Okay? And we chose that because that encompasses the significant portion of both LTD and LTP windows, and it's an interval over which the LTD window is bigger than the LTP window. That is, you have an LTD-biased rule, and when you apply the uncorrelated firing, it turns out you generate LTD. That's what's shown here in the black symbols. Now, you can explicitly show that that depression is due to the fact that the LTD window is long, because you can repeat exactly the same experiment, but now impose uncorrelated firing over only plus or minus 10 milliseconds, and that turns out to be an interval over which the integrals of these two windows is about the same. And in that case, you don't get depression. So when you have an LTD-biased learning rule, STDP rule like this, you get both elements of causality and of correlation driving plasticity. And this really matches what's observed at the systems level at a lot of synapses. Okay. That is pretty much all I wanted to say about cellular mechanisms. Except, if you guys are interested, we can go into tons of detail, because this is a huge area of research in STDP. Why is it that when the presynaptic spike leads the postsynaptic spike by 10 milliseconds, there's enough overlap between glutamate and that postsynaptic depolarization to drive LTP, whereas when the order is reversed, there's less overlap or something to make less calcium come in to cause LTD? To summarize, let me just say that nobody knows the full set of answers yet, and it's clear that it's going to be complicated, but the basic finding so far from many studies has been that the difference between pre-leading post and post-leading pre is the total amount of calcium that comes in. There's something about the way that the spikes backpropagate, and there's something about the way the NMDA receptors are built so that that order actually matters and determines the amount of calcium that comes in leading to LTP or LTD. We can get back to that at the end if you're interested in that. Okay. Current themes. This is how I want to close off the part of what we talk about that's about cellular mechanisms. What are people studying these days for STDP? Well, these STDP rules I showed you about were either based on the pairing of single pre- and postsynaptic spikes or little small bursts of three or four spikes. That doesn't necessarily tell you how a synapse will respond to some complex natural spike drain, such as it might experience during some learning paradigm, and you want to know what would STDP predict, and can it predict accurately what actually happens, and so there's a lot of work on that. In addition, as was observed earlier, the differences in how backpropagating spikes move suggest that there may be different learning rules for STDP, let's say proximally versus distally, or at apical dendrites versus basal dendrites. And we now know that that's absolutely true, but we don't know the general rules for it yet, and that's being worked on a lot. But there's been one strong presumption from that, which is that if different branches of dendrites have different STDP rules, then that would suggest that they select which synapses to reinforce based on those different rules. And that would predict that you should get a functional clustering of synapses with like properties onto similar regions of the dendrites. So they should cluster together on the dendrites. And there's a lot of investigation now over whether that's the case and whether this is something that happens with STDP rules. But a major, major question, and this is what I want to get into in whatever time we have remaining, is that this is a nice learning rule that you can look at in slice preparation. And it's a learning rule that, as I showed you, seems to work in Xenopus optic tectum. But is this really a learning rule that we should think about being a main driver for information storage in broader networks, in mammalian brain and cortex, for example? And so there's been a lot of work to test whether that's true. So do you guys have questions you want to raise about the cellular side of things before we jump to slightly more systems-level questions?
In LTP, you said their calcium will generate more ample channels, right? So what happens in LTD? Does it degenerate the ample channels?
Yeah, the question is, in LTD, how does the calcium coming in cause depression of the synapse? In the hippocampus, where it's been studied best, there's very good evidence that that calcium leads to a signaling cascade which causes either the withdrawal of AMPA receptors from the membrane or maybe the lateral dispersion of those receptors away from the synapse. But in addition, you can change the phosphorylation state of AMPA receptors, which changes their single-channel conductance, which changes how much current they generate in response to glutamate, and that will change the strength of the synapse also. And then there really, it's not ruled out that there aren't presynaptic changes as well, and at some synapses, including actually one we study in somatosensory cortex, it's clear that there are presynaptic changes with LTD that could explain a lot of it as well.
Are there any other neurotransmitters that are involved? Like if you have, and I don't know if this happens, but if you have NMDA channels and you have like other excitatory neurotransmitters as well in synapse, can you
Yeah, the question is, how do other transmitters or modulators come into play in driving or maybe modulating LTP and LTD or STDP? I think the bottom line rule is anything you can do to increase the polarization of the dendrite will bias plasticity towards LTP. And anything that you can do to hyperpolarize the postsynaptic element will either drive the synapses more towards LTD or may prevent plasticity altogether. And so by providing certain modulators, like muscarinic acetylcholine receptor activation or noradrenergic receptor activation, you can definitely push things in those directions. Inhibitory transmitters also have a big effect. All these cells receive a lot of inhibition. Inhibition prevents dendrites from depolarizing, and so if you have enough inhibition around, you can actually pretty effectively prevent cells from depolarizing strongly enough to undergo LTP. By tuning the amount of inhibition, you can shift learning rules from LTP towards LTD, etc. So there's many, many ways, or many, many aspects of synaptic transmission that have a big impact on how these rules work. And actually, for that reason, from the perspective of a biologist, it's very difficult to evaluate sometimes how these learning rules are implemented in neural networks because, you know, let's say an STDP rule that might be implemented at some synapse is based on the mean STDP rule, let's say, observed in the B and Poo experiment, which was under a particular condition with a particular type of activity pattern, and there's really no guarantee that the rule might, you know, the rule might change 25% or 30% or more, or fundamentally. Under different conditions, and we don't know enough about plasticity yet, I think, to be able to know which of these STDP rules is kind of the normative rule that should stand for all the others.
Has there been any speculation on the role of glial cells bringing calcium out of the synapse, and how it might affect this plus or minus 50 millisecond window?
That's a great question. The question is, how could glial cells affect the window for STDP? So glial cells are sucking glutamate out of the synapse at all times, among other things, potassium, lots of things. And it is known that the baseline level of activity in synapses and the baseline desensitization of AMPA receptors, which is sensitive to the amount of glutamate that's hanging around, will affect the amount of LTP or LTD that you get. So I think it would certainly be expected that glia would affect either the strength of plasticity or maybe even the shape or the windows of the STDP rule. But I don't know of an experiment that has explicitly tested quantitatively how that works. That would be interesting to look at. Okay. Let's move on to questions about whether STDP is a relevant learning role in vivo. And I'm thinking forward to what I want to tell you guys. And we need to cut something. Let's cut this. I was going to show you some data showing that in mammalian cerebral cortex, you can induce spike time-independent plasticity in vivo by having an electrode in one cell, making it spike when you want in relation to some natural sensory-evoked synaptic input to that cell, and that drives STDP. But that's actually very similar to the Zhang et al. Experiment in Xenopus tectum I told you about. So let's go to an interesting experiment that was done by Young Dan at Berkeley, trying to ask, is spike timing dependent plasticity naturally engaged by sensory experience in animals? And where this is very different from the experiments we've talked about so far is that all of what we've discussed has used a recording electrode inside a postsynaptic cell to artificially impose a spike, to inject current and impose a spike in that cell when you want. So the experimenter controls the timing, the delta T in the STDP rule, by injecting that spike relative to when synaptic input occurs. Okay? But in this experiment, what they want to do is use natural stimuli, as may occur during normal sensory processing, to ask whether carefully timed natural stimuli might induce STDP. The experiment is done in visual cortex, and just as a little introduction, the cortex has multiple layers, which are numbered 1 through 6. Sensory input primarily ascends from the thalamus to the main input layer, which is called layer 4. And then cells in layer 4 project many places, but one of them is up to layer 2, 3. And then in many areas of the cortex, particularly in primary areas of the cortex, like primary visual cortex, the cortex is divided in the other dimension as well into columns. And each column receives a slightly different thalamic input and processes that input slightly differently, such that each column represents a different type of sensory stimulus. And in the visual cortex, the aspect that we'll talk about is that in a given column, cells are tuned to respond only to stimuli that have edges of a certain orientation. So that you may have one column that only responds to vertically oriented bars, and the next door column may respond to bars that have a slightly different orientation, and the next column over progressively more and progressively more, etc. They're arrayed in a nice map of orientation. Now each of these columns has a similar circuit within it, and very importantly, at the level of layer 2, 3, these cells make synapses to neighboring columns. Okay. So there's interaction between the columns. And the synapse that is going to be focused on in this experiment is this, what we call a horizontal synapse, from one column to the next, and from one column to the next. So they're focusing on these. Now when I say that a column is tuned to a stimulus of a particular orientation, what I mean is if you flash a bar of that orientation, you will preferentially cause cells in this column to spike. If you flash a bar of this orientation, you'll preferentially cause cells in that column to spike. Okay, so what's the experiment? They knew from this anatomy that those horizontal projections exist, they reasoned from that there may be synapses that they could drive to produce STDP. So they're imagining three cells, A, B, and C. Each cell is in one orientation column. Cell A is in the orientation column that likes vertical bars. Cell B likes bars that are slightly leaning to the right. Cell C likes bars that are slightly leaning to the left. And they have horizontal connections between them such that cell C projects to cell A and cell B projects to cell A. Okay? This is absolutely true in terms of the neuroanatomy. They did a previous paper before this one, actually I guess it was going on at the same time, showing that if you make a slice preparation of visual cortex and you artificially cause a given cell to spike and its postsynaptic partner to spike, and you analyze the strength of these horizontal synapses, that these horizontal synapses exhibit STDP in the classic sense I showed before. So you can make them do it in the slice. The question is here, do they do it in vivo in the whole animal? So here's their hypothesis. Okay, if these synapses are susceptible to STDP, then you should be able to define the orientations for each column, and let's call this stimulus 0, or S0 activates cell A, S plus activates cell B, S minus activates cell C, okay? If you flash, these are just static bars, right? So if you flash them, in this case, S plus, a bar leading to the right, followed a few milliseconds later by a vertical bar, S0, so bar leading to the right, vertical, bar leading to the right, vertical, in that order, S plus leads S0, then this S plus will activate this cell, causing it to spike. And then a few milliseconds later, when you flash S0, you'll make this cell spike. That is, you've imposed a B leading A spike timing, right? And so if that synapse is susceptible to STDP, that should strengthen the synapse, okay? Now they predict, what would happen if that synapse were strengthened? We're done with our conditioning. The synapse is strong. How are we going to know whether it's strong? Well, cell A, in determining what input to respond to, it responds to inputs coming up to the thalamus, but it's also receiving inputs from these synapses, right? And so if you've made the synapse from B to A stronger, that means that cell A should be driven more effectively by a bar leading to the right than it was before. And thus, if you measure the orientation tuning of cell A, which can be done, that's what's schematized here, you're plotting the strength of the neural response, spikes usually, as a function of what orientation you flash from here, straight up and down here, to leaning over to the right, etc., that the orientation tuning curve of cell A, which is shown up here, should shift from its original orientation to responding slightly better to the orientation of cell B, because now cell B is more effective at driving cell A. Does that make sense? So they're going to use as a probe for whether the synapse is strengthened, whether the orientation tuning curve shifts towards the orientation represented by B. And likewise, if you did the opposite temporal order, you flash S0 and then S plus, that is vertical and then leading to the right. Now you're making A fire before B, so the order is now A then B. Thinking from the point of view of that B to A synapse, that means the postsynaptic cell is firing before the presynaptic cell. The order is now post leading pre. That should weaken the synapse. And when you weaken the synapse, this cell should be less driven by orientations in that direction, and so it should be proportionately more driven by the other orientations. The curve should shift the other way. That's the prediction. So they did this experiment, and this was in anesthetized cats, I believe. They would introduce it. So the cat's under anesthesia, but he's looking at a screen. They project on the screen visual stimuli. This is one of them. These are the actual stimuli they use, bars leaning in different directions. They're measuring the spiking response of a neuron to those bars. This is a classic neurophysiology experiment for measuring how cells represent visual inputs. And they determine what the orientation tuning curve is for a cell by flashing all the different orientations and just measuring the number of spikes the cell produces. And then they try to train or condition the cell by this STDP rule. So in one cell, they would flash a stimulus that's 15 degrees leaning in one direction away from the optimal stimulus for the cell, and then optimal. So leaning and then optimal. And then they wait a second, leaning then optimal for many repetitions. In another cell, or later on in the same cell, they'll pair leaning the other way and then optimal, leaning the other way then optimal, etc. Okay. So after they measure the tuning, they try to impose carefully timed stimuli to induce STDP. And what do they see? They see that the orientation tuning curves of the cells shift exactly as predicted by an STDP rule. And here's an example. This is four different cells, and these are a little bit messy to look at. So let's look maybe down. Let's look at this one first. Okay, the control orientation tuning is shown in black, this line in the middle. And so the cell was initially tuned to an orientation shown by that dashed line, okay, before they did anything. And then they did a pairing where they had the temporal order of events being a bar leaning 15 degrees to the right, immediately followed by the optimal. So it's leaning to the right, leads optimal, right, leads optimal, right, leads optimal 100 times. And then they reassessed tuning, and they got this curve here, and you can see that the tuning shifted in the direction of 15 degrees to the right, exactly as predicted by their model. Then in the same cell, after they measured that tuning curve, they did another pairing where now they did 15 degrees to the left, then optimal, left optimal, left optimal, so it's left leading optimal. And starting from this position now, this is the new tuning curve of the cell, that training caused the tuning to shift back in the other direction towards left leaning. Here's an example of one where they did the converse kind of experiment. Now they assess the tuning first. This is where at the peak of the orientation tuning, and then they flashed optimal, then left, optimal, then left, optimal, then left. And if you work out the logic behind that, that should cause a shift to the right, which it does. And then they did optimal, right, that should cause a shift towards left, which it does. So you can go through the logic of this, and I gave you guys this paper to read, but the directions of the changes, or how the tuning curves change was exactly predicted in terms of direction from STDP rules. And importantly, you get a shift in one direction versus the other direction just by very precise time delays in how these are presented. And here are the time delays they used. They got significant shifts in orientation tuning when one stimulus led the next by, I think that was 8 milliseconds, and somewhere around 12 milliseconds, but not at 35 milliseconds, 40 milliseconds. And they got a significant shift in the other direction at the 8 millisecond time point, but not at longer time points. This looks like an STDP rule, and in fact, this is exactly what you'd predict if this network was being trained by STDP. So these effects in this paper are quite small. They're subtle shifts in orientation tuning, but the amazing thing about them is that you can get a shift in one direction only when stimuli are 0 to 15 milliseconds apart, and you get a shift in the other direction when the stimuli are 8, 10 milliseconds in the other direction, exactly the time scale of STDP. So when this came out, this was really the first, I think, strong piece of in vivo evidence that simple sensory use can drive STDP when those stimuli are precisely timed and therefore produce precisely timed spikes in the cells. Okay, now that's a change in neural tuning. Does that alter visual perception? Well, here they made a prediction about what would happen, okay? Let's imagine the orientation tuning curves of three cells in the cortex. These are cells in three neighboring columns, like over here, okay? Let's imagine the center cell is tuned for this particular orientation in the middle. These are not the dashed lines, but the solid lines. The neighboring cell is tuned for this orientation, the neighboring cell this way is tuned for that orientation, okay? Excuse me. Now, let's imagine what would happen if, because of STDP, we shift all those tuning curves in one direction, such that this tuning curve of this cell shifts to that location, this one shifts to that location according to these arrows, this one shifts to that location, okay? So what I'm trying to explain here is what would happen if STDP caused all these orientation tuning curves to shift, in this case, to the left, towards negative orientations, okay? Well, how would that affect visual perception? The basic idea for how neural circuits represent things like orientation is that there's a distributed population representation, such that you show one stimulus that activates a set of cells, and by interpreting the firing of that set of cells, the brain can infer what the stimulus was. And so if you apply a test stimulus with orientation here where the arrow is, probably a zero on this axis, this test stimulus will activate this cell very strongly before training, right? It intersects with this cell's tuning curve only way down here, so it'll activate that cell only very weakly. It intersects with this cell's tuning curve way down here, so it activates this cell only very weakly. So before training, if you imagine what will be the strength of activation as a function of which column you're recording from, this column will be most responsive, these will be least responsive, so the center of mass of this representation will be right here in the middle, and the brain would say it has the orientation of the stimulus has the orientation of the central column. What happens after STDP? If all these curves shift to the left, now that same test stimulus will intersect with this portion of the central cell's tuning curve because it's shifted over to here, and so it will evoke a slightly smaller response than it did before from that cell. The stimulus will intersect with only now the very tiny tail of the tuning curve of this cell over here, and so it'll cause even a smaller response here. But this cell's tuning curve shifts towards the test stimulus, and so that stimulus will actually activate that cell more strongly than it did before. That is, after training, this stimulus will cause activity as a function of columns in S1 to be shifted more in this direction. And therefore, one would predict that the animal would infer, when it sees that stimulus, that the stimulus will estimate that the orientation of the stimulus is at this location, at the new center of the spatial profile of activity. So you can make, it's a lot of graphs to look at, but basically you're making a simple prediction that if the curves shift one way in orientation space, then the perception, if it's read out by a population code like this, should shift towards the in the opposite direction. Does that happen? Well, they trained three human observers to do a psychophysics test where they're sitting down in front of a computer and those oriented bars come up, and actually there's a series of oriented bars and the people are making an orientation discrimination judgment, okay? And they measure I think in this case they're being asked to identify a vertical stimulus. And they're showing a whole bunch of different orientations and the people rate which one is vertical. And before they do that, people rate the vertical one as the most vertical. But then after making that measurement, they present the humans, the subjects, with exactly the same stimuli that the cat saw of left-leaning straight, left-leaning straight, left-leaning straight, in that order, left leads straight. That should cause all of the orientation tuning curves to shift towards the left. And that means that the stimulus that the person judges to be straight up should be slightly to the right, if training is affecting perception in this way. And it turns out that training can influence perception. It can cause it to shift in one direction, so you misestimate orientation in one direction, or you misestimate it in the other direction. And again, the remarkable thing is those perceptual shifts only happen when the stimuli were applied with these short 10-20 millisecond delays between the two training stimuli. And again, there's the shape, the general shape of an STDP rule. So this paper really suggests, they try to put together three things, which I'm just giving you here in a schematic. These horizontal synapses undergo STDP you can measure in the slice. The tuning curves for orientation undergo a shift which is consistent with STDP when you measure it in an anesthetized cat. And in humans, your perceptual judgment of orientation can be shifted with the same temporal relationship as the tuning curves in response to the same precisely timed stimuli. And I think this is very good evidence that the very precise 10 millisecond scale timing of stimuli that are seen can change something in the cortex, presumably these horizontal connections or something like them, to shift receptive fields and change perception. And thus STDP, or something very much like it, seems to be engaged here to shift perception. Is that clear? It's a complicated paper, but it's really worth reading. I think it's very well done. We only have a few more minutes, so rather than go through what I was going to tell you at the end, let me just summarize it and then we can have some discussion, okay? The example I just showed you from Young Dan's group suggests that if you as an experimenter go out of your way to supply very precisely timed stimuli that makes cells spike in a very precisely timed way, then you can induce something like STDP in vivo. That doesn't really tell you how prominent STDP is going to be as a general learning mechanism, because we're not really consciously looking at precisely timed stimuli with very consistent temporal relations all the time. At least we don't think we are, right? For some aspects of our sensory world, we in fact do this all the time. And one example is motion stimuli. If you think about visual motion, right? The movement of a stimulus across your visual field is a precise spatiotemporal sequence that activates neurons in your visual cortex in a precise spatiotemporal order that actually should produce STDP at synapses between those neurons in exactly the same way. And there's some good evidence that actually that happens with STDP. But there's also evidence that even sensory tasks that appear really inherently non-temporal can induce STDP at synapses, at least, and that happens because there are circuits in the cortex that seem to translate things like the general amount of sensory use into things like the timing of spikes in circuits, and then those changes in timing can drive STDP. And so you can look at the slides if you're interested, and I actually gave you one of my papers that talks about this a little bit, but what we've done is we've looked in somatosensory cortex at a kind of plasticity that occurs in response to simple deprivation of a sensory input. Many different sensory areas of the brain, you can deprive sensory inputs by closing one eye or trimming a whisker on a rat or taping down a finger or having overuse of one finger in the somatosensory system. And these global changes in the amount of sensory use drive changes in sensory maps in the brain. And what we showed is that in rat somatosensory cortex, if you trim a whisker, which causes a reduction in the responsiveness of the brain to that whisker, that deprivation actually accomplishes that plasticity by altering the timing of spikes in somatosensory cortex and inducing what looks like STDP at the layer 4 to layer 2, 3 synapse in S1, and that's responsible for at least a major component of that change in sensory maps that occurs. So that's just an example of how even if you don't have an overtly carefully timed stimulus, you can still engage STDP rules to do the dirty work of producing plasticity in brain circuits. So let me jump to the end there, but I just want to give you some conclusions of what do we really know about STDP at this stage from a biological point of view. It's a highly prevalent learning rule. It's certainly physiologically realistic. It doesn't take much to induce it. Therefore, we think it probably occurs broadly. However, it does remain an empirical question exactly how often it's really used under natural conditions. STDP certainly implements Hebbian learning, and it does so by detecting causation and not simply correlation like earlier Hebbian learning rules. But you do have these STDP rules which are biased towards LTD, which can actually detect both causation and simple correlation. Sensory manipulations like the one I showed you from the Yao and Dan study under the right conditions can drive STDP in vivo, and even under some cases, like my experiments I wasn't able to show you in detail, suggest that STDP can be induced even when you're not overtly controlling the timing of sensory inputs. Now, in addition to these kind of biological observations, from the computational point of view, as you guys perhaps know as well or better than I, STDP has really interesting computational properties which make it useful for thinking about how learning might work in circuits. And so I think this is a really interesting example of how the basic biology and the computation has really come together to put a lot of research emphasis on a learning rule that could do a tremendous amount for the brain. And I think we're still in the stage, I think we've shown that it does a lot, but I don't think we still yet know exactly how much of the brain's burden of learning this particular learning rule is doing. And it's probably going to take a number of years to figure that out. So let me stop there. You guys have questions?
And can you say how long does it take to induce the change in sensation, and also how long does it last?
That's a great question. So how long lasting was this plasticity when they induced it by seeing precisely timed orientation stimuli in the Yao and Dan experiment? I think it took on the order of 5 or maybe 10 minutes for the induction protocol because they used 100 or hundreds of repetitions of those stimuli. And they showed, actually, that the effect only lasts for about 10 minutes, and then it reverses. And this, at first, seems a little bit inconsistent with the idea of LTP. After all, the L in LTP stands for long-lasting. But actually, an important discovery that was made when people started to study LTP and LTD in vivo was that when brain networks are active and doing things, that you can induce plasticity like LTP and LTD, but they tend to be rapidly reversed. And in fact, it's been shown that they're reversed by an active process in which other elements of the activity patterns, like bursting activity that's going on, essentially erase some of that LTP or LTD or restore the synapse to its more original state. You can do manipulations that prevent that erasure, and that makes the learning more long-lasting. But the presumption is, I think, that in order for these learning rules, or any learning rule, to really contribute to long-lasting forms of memory, you need to do something more than just engage it a couple hundred times. You need to maybe have appropriately spaced training, which produces other changes at synapses, which makes them really resistant to erasure, for example.
If you had to bet, would you say that STDP will have emergent properties in memory at a higher, more abstract level than perception learning?
So if I had to bet, would STDP be involved in more than just perceptual learning?
Well, would you see emergent properties like we saw in this perceptual learning? In this paper.
If you're
learning a sequence and you're given one unit in that sequence, we have stronger associations for the next.
Yeah, so a specific question then is sequence learning. I think that in the most general case, I guess you could say that if any aspect of a sensory input or a motor plan or any kind of program in the brain is represented by a spatiotemporal sequence of spiking activity. That is, if there's some aspect of a temporal code for some piece of information in the cortex, then you could certainly imagine that STDP would be well suited to teach temporal codes, right? In the broadest case. For sequences, it seems particularly obvious, right? If you flash the sequence ABC in front of an animal and it learns ABC, and there was 20 milliseconds between the A and the B and the C, in some fully connected network, you would be reinforcing A to B synapses and B to C synapses, and you should increase that representation. But I think, you know, a more probing idea of whether that can occur really requires better knowledge or detailed knowledge about how circuits might use temporal codes to encode information. So you can imagine that there may be some parts in the brain that encode the sequence ABC not by a temporal code at all, but by some spatial population code, right? And in that case, you might imagine that STDP wouldn't particularly help learn the sequence per se. So I guess I could easily see computationally how STDP could do very useful things, particularly for things like sequence learning. But I don't think the experiment, and certainly, as you probably heard from Terry, computationally, the STDP formalism, that kind of way of describing learning rules, can be really useful, right, in implementing sequence learning. But from a neurobiological perspective, I don't think the experiment has been done outside of these simple forms of perceptual learning to show yet that STDP is really doing something more emergent. My bet is it probably will, but I think we're a long way from showing it.
To me, I recall that when you have very closely spaced auditory stimuli, say within 10 or 20 milliseconds of each other, they end up sounding like just one event. They're not separate. So I'm actually wondering whether or not, in some ways, this isn't a way to learn sequences, but it's a sequencing mechanism that is often a different range of parameter values than the kinds of sequences that we actually can process perceptually.
Right. So the question is, how could this relate to what happened? Well, maybe the broadest way of saying it is, how could this relate to different timescales of sequences? And I with regards to the auditory example, depending on what part of the brain you record in all sorts of different sensory systems, you can get fundamentally different types of temporal interactions between inputs, right? You can have, in the auditory case, maybe the most extreme case is something like a masking phenomenon, right? Where if you have two stimuli that are very near each other in time, perceptually you sometimes don't even hear the first, you just hear the second. That can happen very low down in the nervous system. In some parts of the brain, there seems to be a lot of temporal fidelity in how sensory inputs drive spikes. In other parts of the brain, a lot of the temporal fidelity is lost because the circuits are computing other things. They're not keeping track of time. And so I would not make the prediction I would say in the broadest sense that in order to understand how information is stored at any synapse, you need to understand what the learning rule is at that synapse, but you also need to understand what the natural patterns of spiking are at that synapse during normal behavior that are engaging the learning rule, right? One of them engages the other and you get learning or information storage as an output. And so if you're in a part of the nervous system where you don't have accurate encoding of the timing of each event, I don't think you can use STDP to learn a sequence of those individual events, right? But if you're in some other part of the nervous system where there's a closer temporal relationship between some sequence of sensory inputs in the external world and some sequence of spikes in the brain, then I think you have more fodder to think that STDP might be storing information. The timescale issue you raise, I think, is a really important one, and maybe this is a good contrast with what Terry has done work on, and I don't know if he talked about when he talked with you guys, but even though the formalism between STDP and temporal difference learning is very strong, right, suggesting that this kind of pre-leading post, post-leading pre-difference is a very useful way of thinking about how sequence and timing information may be learned, there, they're talking about learning on the timescales of seconds, minutes, and longer. And here, we're talking about learning on the timescales of milliseconds. And so I don't think we know exactly how to bridge one to the other neurobiologically. You can write models that have certain types of processing in circuits that allow, for example, when an event occurs, you have some strong representation right away, but then there's still a trace of that remaining, you know, seconds later. And then under those conditions, STDP can learn longer sequences. But in real brains that are representing long intervals between elements of a sequence, these 10 millisecond scale STDP rules by themselves can't do it, right? They may represent part of an iceberg of a set of processes that can do it, but they by themselves can't do it. Does that
get us up? Yeah, I'm trying to remember, was there anything in your talk were you always talking about experiments where someone is manipulating the neurons directly as opposed to an event?
So the Yao and Dan experiments with learning the orientation, there was no manipulation of the neurons directly there. That was just showing sensory stimuli, one stimulus, and then a 10 millisecond delay, and then another stimulus.
But they're not learning the sequence. You're using a sequential presentation. They're not learning the sequence. What I'm wondering is whether or not there's actually a kind of a protective bubble around the temporal characteristics of the STDP such that it can be used to do its work, whether it's encoding temporal sequence or any one of other kinds of information. And the time scale at which we can actually perceptually deal with sequence may be different enough that there's some protection of the mechanism that's a more general mechanism.
Yeah. I agree with that. In fact, my view is that STDP allows certain types, allows the brain to store information based on temporal patterns of spikes. Now, depending on what part of the brain you're in, those temporal patterns of spikes mean different things. And therefore, STDP can, in principle, be used to store many different types of information, limited, this is what I was trying to get at before, limited by what types of information are encoded on those by spiking on those timescales in that part of the brain. So I wouldn't rule out that it was, I wouldn't necessarily say there's a protective bubble that keeps it from representing a longer timescale process, but I would say that if it is going to help represent a longer timescale process, something in the neural circuitry has to translate timescales. There has to be another process.
Similar line of question. I can see where short-term memory could play a role in recycling events so that they're in proximity so that LTP and LTD could work. But I'm having a hard time saying how LTP and LTD could produce short-term memory.
Yeah, the question is how LTP and LTD might produce short-term memory.
You can handle kind of a one-shot learning situation so that you get things into a fast code that you can then work with in order to learn sequences.
Well, I guess I haven't thought about this specifically for sequence learning, but I think most experiments on the relationship, well, at least most animal experiments looking at, you know, specific forms of learning and how LTP and LTD might be involved are actually not focused on short-term learning per se, like working memory type learning, but on getting information into longer term memory, just in terms of how the experiments are done. The idea, I mean, for hippocampal type memories, or there's this idea of replay, that replay can compress the timescales of events down to a timescale that might be on the timescale more suitable for driving STDP. But then I agree that you're right that there's a there's kind of a coding challenge of if you learn something by these rules at that time scale, how is it ultimately brought back to the relevant time scale of what was actually learned? I guess intuitively I don't see that as necessarily a challenge for the learning rule. I see that more as, again, a challenge of coding, right? There's no reason that you can't encode a sequence that originally occurred on the seconds-long timescale by some burst of neural activity that occurs on a much faster timescale if you have the circuitry built to do that. And I guess I would need to learn more about what's known about the neural representation of actual sequence processing to know whether that's possible.
So it seems like mostly talking about like procedural learning and sort of memory and sort of something like declarative memory where there isn't necessarily any repetition of the stimulus. Like, do you think that this is relevant, or is like STD
Yeah, that's a great question. So is STDP useful for something that might be declarative or one trial kind of learning without a lot of repetitions? I think, you know, inherent in the idea that timing can contain the information to drive learning has to be that something has to stick out in the statistics of the timing, right, in order for that information to be written into a neural circuit. And so in the cerebral cortex, for example, where based on what we know about cortical plasticity, which is mostly from low-level sensory, like primary sensory areas of cortex, there's really no indication that in cortical areas you get effective representation of one trial declarative kind of learning. And there, instead, the indication is that changes in the statistical pattern of sensory inputs over many hours or days or weeks ends up producing changes in sensory maps and receptive fields and all that. And I think based on what we know about STDP, it makes a lot of sense to understand how that might happen. How it might underlie a more one trial type of learning, I think is difficult, but I think that's a problem that's not just for STDP. I think that problem is shared for many different types of LTP rules, right? If LTP is driven by some conjunction between presynaptic activity and postsynaptic depolarization, whether it's timing dependent or not, and you activate some set of synapses onto hippocampal neuron to do some kind of declarative learning, how do you know how do you ensure in the circuitry that that one sensory event lays down a strong enough trace to be long-lasting? It's a tough problem, right? And in a lot of modeling, it's kind of assumed that the threshold for even getting a synapse to be plastic, or at least to exhibit long-term plasticity, just has to be really high, so you don't get there a lot. Or it's assumed that you might have some other kind of signal, like a gating signal, which turn on more permissive periods for that kind of plasticity. But I think this is a great mystery for how information can be effectively written in a structure like the hippocampus. Okay, great. Thank you, guys.